This episode was first posted July 6th, 2009. I thought the film was prescient then, but not nearly as much as it is now.
This is Movies for the Blind, episode 86, Things to Come, part 1.
Why should we surrender life to the brutes and fools?
Hello and welcome to Movies for the Blind, where you can enjoy films without looking at a screen. I'm Valerie Hunter. The writer H.G. Wells is best known for being one of the fathers of science fiction, or what he sometimes called scientific romances, with such classic books as The Island of Dr. Moreau, The War of the Worlds, The Time Machine, and The Invisible Man, all of which have been rich fodder for filmmakers over the years. During his life, he was also well known as a socialist, espousing a world state without borders, run largely by scientists, engineers, and others among the best and the brightest, while still allowing everyone as much freedom as possible without threatening the freedoms of others. Some may call this utopian, and indeed such a view came through in much of his work. One of the works which reflected that view was The Shape of Things to Come in 1933, which he would adapt into a screenplay 3 years later. While his socialist hopes have not entirely come to pass, more than a few predictions he made did. As you listen to this movie, especially the first half of this episode, keep in mind that at the time, Hitler was still establishing his stranglehold on Germany. World War II would not begin in Europe until 1939, and the Blitz of London would not begin until a year after that. From 1936, this is Things to Come. H.G. Wells. Things to Come. Produced by Alexander Korda. Directed by William Cameron Menzies. Settings designed by Vincent Korda. Photography by Georges Perrineau. Special effects directed by Ned Mann. Music specially composed by Arthur Bliss. Musical director, Muir Matheson. Production manager, David B. Cunningham. Recording director, A.W. Watkins. Aeronautical advisor, Nigel Tangi. Supervising editor, William Hornbeck. Film editors, Charles Crichton and Francis Lyon. Assistant director, Jeffrey Boothby. The cast. John Cabal, Oswald Cabal, Raymond Massey. Pippa Passworthy, Raymond Passworthy, Edward Chapman. The Boss, Ralph Richardson. Roxana, Rowena, Margarita Scott. Theotokopoulos, Cedric Hardwick. Dr. Harding, Morris Bradell. Mrs. Cabal, Sophie Stewart. Richard Gordon, Derek DeMarney. 1940. Christmas. Every town. A large city under wintry clouds. Cars, buses, and pedestrians bustle through the busy downtown streets at night. Standing before a shop window, a little boy in a cap smiles at a toy fort with soldiers on horseback and tanks. Nearby, a vendor hawks Christmas holly, while behind him, a newspaper truck displays a sign saying the world on the brink of war. Shoppers pass a chalk artist finishing a Merry Christmas message on the sidewalk. A group of somber people walk the streets, reverently singing past newspaper posters declaring a war scare. The evening's bustle continues, past shops and carts, in a large shiny cinema. Another newspaper poster of war stands beside a stopping car with a smiling couple inside. Near some people getting off a bus, a sign outside a theater announces the Christmas pantomime inside, as a news hawker wears a sandwich board sign saying, "Warning to Europe." Traffic crawls past Sanderson's department store, as an elderly woman waits to receive a Christmas turkey wrapped fresh from a butcher. "The world at the brink of war," says a newspaper poster beside two children chatting. More ominous posters wave in the breeze. A carefree group hurry from another theater.
bumping into another news seller. More war scare signs haunt the streets near the sign for turkeys, and a small marionette of Santa Claus dances on the sidewalk. Revelers use noisemakers beside signs reading War Storm, another 10,000 air fighters. Europe is arming. Rumors of war, the truth. Alarming speech by Air Minister is the headline of a newspaper read by a gentleman in his residence. Another man enters the room.
Hello, young Harding. You're early.
Yes, I've finished up. It was too late starting fresh. What's all this fuss about in the papers tonight, Mr. Cavell?
Wars and rumors of wars.
Crying wolf?
Someday a wolf will come. These fools are capable of anything.
In that case, what happens to medical research?
It has to stop.
That'll mess me up.
Mess you up. Mess everything up. My God, if war gets loose again.
Happy Christmas, everyone. While shepherds watch their flocks by night.
A short, bespectacled man walks in.
What's the matter with you fellas?
Harding shows him the paper.
All that. This little upset across the water doesn't mean anything. Threatened men live long and threatened wars never occur. Another speech by him.
I tell you, there's nothing in it. It's just to buck people up about the air estimates. Now, why meet wars halfway? Why not look on the bright side of things?
You're all right. Your business is going up. You've got a jolly wife, a pretty home.
All's right with the world, eh? All's right with the world.
Certainly.
Passworthy, you should have been called Pippa Passworthy.
Oh, and Cabell, you've been smoking too much. You're not eupeptic. Oh, come on, it's Christmas. Noel, 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 Noel.
Harding steps away from Passworthy and Cabal as they sing.
Israel.
Later, beside a tree, children play with their new toys as the men and a woman watch with an older man.
Nice toys they have nowadays. Nice toys. The toys we had were simpler, ever so much simpler. Noah's Arks and wooden soldiers. Nothing complex like these. You know, I wonder sometimes if perhaps all these new toys aren't a bit too much for them.
It teaches them to use their hands.
And I suppose their grandchildren will see even more wonderful things. Progress. Progress. I'd like to see the wonders they'll see.
Don't be too sure of progress.
Oh, listen to the incurable pessimist.
What's to stop progress nowadays? War.
Passworthy looks up at Cabal.
Firstly, there isn't going to be a war, and secondly, war doesn't stop progress. It stimulates progress.
Yeah, war can be a highly stimulating thing. But you can overdo a stimulant.
Oh, well, after all, I'll be exaggerating the horrors of war. Don't we rather overdo that song? After all, you know, the last war wasn't as bad as some people make out. We didn't worry. Something great seemed to have got hold of us.
Something greater still may get hold of us next time. If we don't end war, war will end us.
Well, what can you do?
Yeah. What can we do?
The woman considers. Later still, the glowing lights on the tree grow dim. The streets outside the Cabal residence have emptied. The Cabals and Harding see out Passworthy.
Peace on earth, goodwill towards men. Real old-fashioned Christmas this year. Fresh little snow with a nip in the air, eh?
What is that? Sounded like a gun.
Guns here. Merry Christmas, Cabal. Here's to another good year for all of us. Another year of recovery, eh?
What's a searchlight doing now?
They all step away from the door and look up.
Yes. Well, it must be anti-aircraft maneuvers.
Maneuvers at Christmas? No.
Listen, guns again.
John Cabal runs back in to answer the phone. The others listen outside.
Yeah? Cabal speaking. The hill's high over from the bridge.
He steps out.
Mobilization.
Oh, God.
Perhaps it's only precautionary mobilization.
Hurrying back inside. John switches the station on the radio.
The unknown aircraft passed over Sea Beach and dropped bombs within a few hundred yards of the waterworks. They then turned seaward again. By this time, they've been picked up with the searchlights of the battleship Dinosaur. Before they could mount out of range, she had opened upon them with her anti-aircraft guns. Unfortunately, without result.
Of course, everyone has said this time they'll start without any declaration of war.
Oh, listen.
We do not yet know the nationality of these aircraft, though, of course, there can be little doubt of their place of origin. But before all things, it is necessary for the country to keep calm. No doubt the losses suffered by the fleet are serious.
That losses of the fleet?
Listen.
And it is imperative that the whole nation should at once stand to arms. Orders for a general mobilization have been issued, and the precautionary civilian organization against gas will at once be put into operation. Our instructions have just come to hand. We shall cut off for 5 minutes, then read you the general instructions. Please call in all your friends. Call in everyone you can.
You've got your stimulant, Passworthy. Something great has got you. War has come.
Outside, people read a poster of the National Defense Act. A news poster on a bus reads, "Stand to arms as servicemen climb aboard." Traffic fills the streets of every town once more, deliberate and urgent. A man kisses his wife, then descends into the underground, while a troop truck pulls up to a curb and allows soldiers to get off. A convoy of motorcycles passes Sanderson's, followed by a truck pulling men and military equipment. Pedestrian traffic becomes a little more frantic as more military vehicles are given right of way. The motorcycles fill the streets. An anti-aircraft gun rolls past, with more and more motorcycles, leading a large official sedan, which stops. A truck carrying loudspeakers stops as well.
Please keep still and listen. War has broken out suddenly. There may be an air raid, but it is not likely to be a very serious one. You must be prepared for it. The danger will not be great. As soon as the danger is over, bugles will sound all clear. The streets will be dangerous. Do not assemble in crowds. Keep indoors. Go home. Those who are far from home can take refuge in the underground railway. Go home. Go home. Go home. Get out of the square. Get out of the street.
The frightened civilians hurry to obey.
Put out your lights. Open the windows.
People in their flats obey as well. Making way for more trucks and guns, people scurry for shelter. The cabal's little boy sleeps with a teddy bear. Standing over him, his mother looks up at John in his uniform.
My dear, are you sorry we had these children?
No. Life must carry on. Why should we surrender life to the brutes and fools?
I loved you. I wanted to serve you and make life happy for you. But think of the things that may happen to them. Were we selfish?
You weren't afraid to bear them. We were children yesterday. We're anxious. But we're not afraid. Rip. Courage, my dear. And may that little heart have courage.
In the darkest night, uniformed men walk through the fog. John closes the door of his residence and walks off. Nearby, Passworthy stands with a boy.
Are you officer, Daddy?
Well, you've got to do your bit, you know, sonny. Got to do your bit.
I'm an officer too, Daddy.
That's the spirit. Carry on, sir. Carry on.
They salute, and Passworthy picks the boy up.
Goodbye, son.
They kiss.
There.
And he sets him down.
Quick, Bob.
Pretending his case is a bass drum, he leads his boy through a gate and walks off with a wave. The boy turns and marches back, as many young soldiers do, helmets on their heads and guns slung over their shoulders. In the square,
they're approaching every car. town. An air raid is approaching every town. Gas masks are being distributed. See that they're fit tightly behind the ears.
Soldiers in trucks pass out the gas masks among the remaining civilians, who hurry for the underground and other shelters as more anti-aircraft guns roll in. The guns are pointed toward the skies, with more truck and pedestrian traffic rushing around them. Another huge gun rolls into place, and people scurry past a large poster reading "War, the Truth." Running over the Christmas chalk drawing on the sidewalk, scuffles ensue. Civilian men climb over abandoned cars. New guns are pointed skyward. People pull the gas masks on over their faces. Crowds pack the stairways to the underground, while in the square, the guns are turned. Fire trucks are ready. More guns turn with their operators scanning the skies. The civilian rush becomes more panicked, more frenzied. And the guns keep turning. They start firing. The lights of the square go black as the guns fire into the sky. The cinema sign is blown to pieces, and rubble falls after it. The anti-aircraft guns keep the defense, but another building is bombed. A fire truck speeds down a street just before more bombs bring down edifices onto some of the troops, with more explosions hemming them in. The guns fire on, and more bombs hit Sanderson's. As people struggle to pull others away, the fire trucks speed by, and a tower is hit. Streets are choked with smoke and debris. A double-decker bus lurches off, and more bombs come down. An explosion rolls a car onto its side. People climb out from rubble, only to be struck with full force. Others climb out past them, while some cannot go far. As men and women run, a woman in the back of a truck is hit, but the driver is not. The helmeted soldiers hurry to recover what they can, but more bombs come down around them. Stretcher bearers transport the casualties past twisted steel and crumbled stone through the smoke and desolation. Buildings have been leveled. Lights are dim and jumbled. The cinema sign is destroyed. Near where Passworthy left his son, the boy lies nearly buried in rubble. Every town is dark, save for the glow of the fires all around. Regardless, soldiers march onward. A tank powers over a field. A line of huge ships cut through the seas. Battles rage on rough lands, with explosions billowing over mud and rolling hills. Some tanks are stopped, with debris scattering everywhere, but others move on as relentlessly as the fire raining down on them. Smaller tanks power through walls of debris. Daylight, white cliffs tower over water. Above, lines of airplanes, dozens of them, emerge from the clouds. They soar over the cliffs. Majestic cliffs seem small below the giant swarm of planes. over what were once villages, overwhelming the sky. In the swarm, one of many pilots fly in a covered cockpit. A biplane with an uncovered cockpit confronts him from behind. The first plane, whiter and sleeker, tries to evade its pursuer. John Cabal is the pursuer, firing at the other plane. He swoops closer and hits his target. The other pilot struggles to regain control of his plane, but to no avail, as it plummets from the sky. When it crashes, John flies down after it. Soon after, the crumpled heap of the defeated plane is approached on the ground by the victorious plane, which slowly comes to a stop. John climbs out. As he jumps down, the other pilot climbs out of his plane, but stumbles and falls. Pulling him up, John drags him away from the plane as it smolders. John sets the pilot down to rest on his leg as he sits. He takes off the pilot's goggles.
Bad shape, eh? Why does it come to this?
God, why do we have to murder each other?
Go, my friend. That is my guess. It's a bad guess.
As the gas drifts over the field toward them, John searches for a mask.
Funny if I'm killed by my own poison.
Quick, get this.
John forces the pilot's gas mask over his face. Then he pulls out his own. A little girl runs toward them. When John gives her his mask, the pilot takes off his.
Give it to her. I've given plenty to others. Why should I not have some myself? Give it to her. I'm done.
John puts the pilot's mask on the girl.
Breathe through your mouth.
Then puts his own on himself. Standing, John hurries the girl away, looks back at his enemy pilot, and drops a pistol within reach before he leaves with her. The pilot considers.
I dropped the gas on her. Maybe I've killed her father and mother. Maybe I've killed her whole family. And then I go and give up my mask to save her. That's funny. That's a joke.
Lifting the girl into the cockpit, John climbs in after her and drives the plane away from the burning, defeated plane. The war continues on battlefield wastelands, with tanks rolling and men trudging on. Through 1945, 1955, more armed men climb out from battlements and run toward the enemy. They lie down, fire, and trudge on. Through 1960, wind blows shreds of cloth on tangled barbed wire. Fields start to grow over, with collections of debris in the distance. A crudely printed newspaper, the National Bulletin, for September 21st, 1966, is headlined, "The End is in sight. Victory is coming." The enemy is near the breaking point and defeated on land and sea, have nevertheless retained a few aeroplanes which are difficult to locate and destroy. Them they are using to spread the wandering sickness, a fever of mind and body. Avoid sites where bombs have fallen. Do not drink stagnant water. 1966. Every town. Amid the ruins of the square, officials in old soldiers' helmets give scraps to a bedraggled woman and her child. The ruins provide shelter, where a man descends a ladder to others who cower in darkness. In the wake of war and social breakdown, a strange and terrible pestilence, the wandering sickness, spread unchecked throughout the world. At the gate of a hospital, as makeshift as everything is makeshift, a hand struggles to pull its owner up a post to sit. Bare-chested and dazed, the man stands and staggers outside the gate and away. Another man spots him.
Look, he's carrying infection.
Several people nearby scatter to escape the wandering sick man. At the lab of Dr. Harding.
Harding, here.
A young woman gets a bottle and examines it.
Mary Harding.
She approaches Harding as he turns from a microscope.
There's no more left, Father. This is the last drop.
He throws down a tool.
God.
And goes to a window.
What is the use of trying to save this mad world from its punishment?
Oh, Father, if only you could get some sleep.
How can I sleep? See how they wander out to die.
They watch the sick man wander on. And people hurrying away from him. Sick man staggers with his arms out in front of him. A stocky man watches and grabs another man.
Why don't you shoot them? It's their lives to ours. Let's get God to make a court.
He leads the other man off. Yet another man runs into a ruin and comes out with a man with a rifle who aims at the sick man, who bends over and collapses. With his daughter, Harding turns from the window.
That's how they dealt with the pestilence in the Dark Ages.
A young man enters.
Richard.
My sister.
Gone! How do you know?
Her heart beats faster, and she feels faint, and
she won't answer.
What can I do for her? I thought something might be known.
Janet. And you poor dear. Richard.
I might be infected.
Harding hurries out. And his daughter follows with Richard. To Richard's sister, lying in bed, staring into space.
Is there nothing to make her comfortable?
Stepping up to Richard, Harding puts a hand on his shoulder.
Nothing. There's nothing will make anyone comfortable anymore.
Harding walks away. And the gunman patrols. Later, Richard's sister writhes in bed, then sits up with wide eyes, pushing aside her blankets. She sits on the edge of the bed and stands, slumping back briefly. She staggers from the bed and wanders across the room to leave their ruin. From the top of another ruin, the gunman watches as people scurry when they see Richard's sister walk out of Sanderson's, her arms outstretched before her. Inside, Richard finds her gone. As he hurries out, the gunman keeps watching the sister, who turns towards some fleeing people. The rifle is raised, and Richard searches for it. He spots him.
Don't shoot.
When the gunman pauses, the stocky man arrives.
Shoot, I tell you, shoot!
Taking the rifle, he does it himself. And she falls.
That's the way to do it. Shoot him!
1967. No man has ever reckoned the ravages of the wandering sickness, like the Black Death in the Middle Ages. It killed more than half the human race. No one who caught it survived. Only gradually did men realize that the epidemic was over and that social vitality was returning. 1970. While the ruins are unchanged, people bustle about market stalls. As a bell is rung, a man stands to read the national bulletin from a wall.
May Day, 1970. The pestilence has ceased. Thanks to the determined action of our chief in shooting all wanderers, there have been no cases for 2 months. The pestilence has been conquered. The chief is preparing to resume hostilities against the hill people with the utmost vigor. Soon we shall have victory and peace. All is well. God save the chief. God save our land.
At a dilapidated airplane hangar, Richard looks up.
Any more insulated wire?
But no rubber wire at all.
Any rubber tape?
There's not a scrap left in the place. We used the last on the other motor.
Oh, what's the use? There's no petrol anyway. I don't believe there's 3 gallons of petrol left in this accursed ruin of a town. What's the good of setting me at a job like this? Nothing will ever fly again. Flying's over. Everything's over. Civilization's dead.
As a small herd of sheep run past a woman washing her naked toddler in a tub, Harding's daughter, Mary, carries a basket in front of 2 horses pulling an old car. Richard steps past a double-decker bus turned into a shack and approaches Mary and the car's driver.
Hello.
It's a road, isn't it?
Yes. It's a good pre-pestilence machine. I oil it and turn it over at times.
You think it'll go fast someday still?
Well, I'm not one of your petrol hoarders. But all the same, that engine turns over still. Why, I remember when I was a lad, when it was new, we thought nothing of going 100 miles in it. A whole 100 miles. Less than 3 hours I've done it in. Well, that sort of thing's all gone now. Gone forever, huh?
Afraid so.
Yep, yep.
The horses pull the old rolls away.
Richard.
What is it?
You won't think me mad.
Why, darling?
I thought I heard an aeroplane this morning. At dawn. I thought it was a dream, but...
Nonsense. I tell you, flying's finished. We shall never get in the air again. Never.
A line of men on horseback approach the edge of town.
Hey, come on, the bus!
People leave their work and gather excitedly for the boss's arrival with his troops. 2 of the horsemen proudly fly flags, and several foot soldiers play fifes and drums. As the troops ride into the square, greeted by happily waving townspeople. In the lead, the boss, the stocky man, wearing an old helmet and a fur vest, acknowledges the crowd. Then rides up to Richard.
Anything to report, Gordon?
Nothing very hopeful, Chief.
I must have those airplanes somehow.
I do what I can, but you can't fly without petrol.
I'll get petrol for you. Trust me, you look after the machines. I know you haven't got the stuff, but you can get round that. For example, transfer parts. Use bits of one to mend another. Be resourceful. Give me only 10 machines in working order. Give me only 5. I don't want them all. And we'll end this war of ours forever. I'll see you get your reward.
He dismounts beside Mary.
Your wife, Gordon? You keep her well hidden. Salutation, lady. Just use your influence with our master mechanic. The combatant state wants his service.
I'm sure my husband does his best for you.
That's hardly enough, lady. The combatant state demands miracles.
Not everyone can work miracles as you do, Chief.
Oh, I'm sure you could work miracles if you tried, lady.
Rudolph!
Another woman stalks up.
Lady, I showed it to you, but you said you didn't want it.
Wodski's been up to his tricks again, he'll have to answer for them.
But he's been keeping things back from me again.
Only if Wodski keeps things back, what do you think of our master mechanic here, the one that may have those planes of mine to end this war of ours with the Hillman?
Well, can't you make him? I thought you could make everybody do everything.
Some things you can't do, madam. You can't fly without petrol. You can't mend machines without tools or material. You've gone back too far. Flying's become a lost skill in every town.
Are you really as stupid as that?
I'm as hopeless as that.
And now, Chief, what are you going to do about it?
He's going to let me have those machines, and I'm going to let him have coal. Stuff to make oil.
It's a lot of skill. It's a dream of the...
A strange plane flies above them.
There it is. You were right. A plane once more.
Looking somewhat like a fat wasp, it passes through fluffy clouds and out.
Look, there he is.
Oh, look.
They watch it begin to descend.
He's shutting off. He's coming down.
What's the meaning of this? They got aeroplanes before us. And you told me we couldn't fly anymore. Well, we've been fumbling, they've been active. Here's some of you, you and you. Find out who this is and what it means. There's only one man in it. Hold him.
Somewhere they can still make new machines. I didn't dream it was still possible.
Yes, but who is this man? How did he dare come here?
Pitch him to the town hall. Guard his machine and bring him to me there.
As the boss stalks off, the plane drifts toward the ground.
Come along, Mary. I must see that machine.
So, who is in that plane and where did it come from? Find out in part 2 of 3 of Things to Come, next time on Movies for the Blind. The boss is being played by one of the great British actors of the 20th century, Ralph Richardson, who said he modeled his character after the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, who led the invasion of Ethiopia the year this film was made. Though Mussolini had started out as a socialist, H.G. Wells was no fan of his fascism, nor of Joseph Stalin's variation of Marxism in the Soviet Union. Richardson's performance echoes a perception of these men and other dictators as putting the ego above the state. Yeah, that's probably not limited to dictators, is it? And we'll get more of it in the next episode. For more information and links about the movies, about description, and how to subscribe, check the blog, moviesfortheblind.com, where you can also find out about this podcast's Creative Commons license. The movies are from the Internet Archive, so please support universal access to human knowledge by visiting and donating at www.archive.org. Thank you for downloading and for listening. Be back next week. Take care.